Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Need expert advice on your family's health? Speak to us today. Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
The plight of the Irish pub has been underlined in a recent report by the Drinks Industry Group of Ireland, revealing that in the region of 1,900 pubs across Ireland, one pub in five in the state have shut since 2005. So are we witnessing the end of the traditional bar? And historically, what was the significance of those pubs? Well, I'm joined in the studio by Professor Dermot Ferret, Professor of Modern Irish History in UCD. So we're going to go right back to talk about the role of pubs right the way through our history. And the number of pubs was a concern when the state was formed over 100 years ago.
It was one of the interesting priorities of the new Free State government in the 1920s. They were under a lot of pressure to set the state on a firm footing politically, but also socially and culturally. We've spoken before, you know, about the impulse towards censorship and making sure that there was a kind of a cultural self-sufficiency. Now, questions had always been there about the excessive number of pubs in Ireland, but it becomes a bit of a crusade in the 1920s. And there is a commission on intoxicating liquor, which is established in 1925 after pressure is generated. And the numbers were quite staggering.
Yeah, because we have comparable with figures, don't
yeah,
we?
Yeah, I mean, there were 17,000 licensed premises in Ireland in the mid-1920s. Now, 13,000 of them were pubs because there were different types of licenses that were offered. And there was a very interesting observation by the writer George Russell in 1925, and he started going through individual towns and he said it's absurd in a country that's desperately trying to find its feet that we are trying to maintain in proportion to our population twice as many licensed premises as England, three times as many as Scotland. And he started going through individual towns and villages and he said, look at Charleston, look at Strokestown, look at Roscommon. And then he honed in on Ballyhaunus. And he said there's one drinking shop for every 20 residents in Ballyhaunus. So he went through it like that. And he said, how many of these towns and villages can boast a gymnasium or a public bath or a library?
But they have 14 pubs.
But they have 14 pubs. He said, you know, those other things are looked on as desperate luxuries, you know, or unaffordable luxuries. So there was much cultural comment on that. But you also, of course, had a very powerful vested interest in the licensed vintners. Mm-hmm. And the licensed vintners was established in 1817. And, you know, in the 19th century, there had been all sorts of issues around licensing and public drunkenness. And we inherited a kind of a bewildering maze of statutes and licensing laws. So they were trying to make sense of it, but they were also trying to shrink it. So they didn't want any more pubs. The Commission on Intoxicating Liquor suggested that there were 191 towns and villages in Ireland that had an excessive number of pubs. And some of them were closed. Their licences weren't renewed and they were compensated. But they're also trying to get rid of the laxity that existed around the endorsement of licences for, you know, conviction on when people have been convicted.
So given that the publicans came together in an organisation in the early 1800s, can we deduce from that that they felt under threat from back then?
It wasn't that they felt under a threat, it's that they saw opportunities for expansion as well, but that they needed, obviously, to be cognizant of government policy, because this is a big revenue generator. Mm-hmm. And they're always on the lookout for what they would regard as excessive duties and taxes. And again, you know, these issues remained relevant throughout the years. But they were also lobbying hard for what they regarded as the unsavoury aspects of drinking in Ireland, that they were the respectable licensed vintners, but there were all sorts of shebeens in operation. There was illicit distillation. There were chemists that were selling spirits. So they always identified their own targets.
All right, so they wanted to protect their, as they saw, legitimate and regulated business in the face of those threats.
Very much. Mm-hmm. And they remained a very powerful lobby group. And this is the interesting thing about the 1920s, because Kevin O'Higgins, as the Minister for Justice, is taking them on to a degree. They want to introduce restricted closing on Sunday as part of the new proposals. They want to reduce the number of licences. And there's also, of course, a wider international climate there post-First World War about prohibition and the role of alcohol in society. So the vintners are very sensitive around the way in which drink is being depicted. And of course, politicians are always playing it safe. Kevin O'Higgins was asked, was Ireland a nation of drunks? And he stood up on the Dáil in 1927 and said, well, that's all a question of angles. How do you define excessive drinking? Is it just because you have X amount of drunks? That is not the criteria by which we should define excessive drinking. But he did acknowledge that £17.5 million was spent over the counter in Ireland in 1926 on drink.
Which was helpful for him and his government.
Absolutely. And that's why, of course, they were always trying to strike a balance.
Was that term, you said it was hard to, you know, define what an alcoholic or a drunkard was. There was that term, though, confirmed drunkard, wasn't
there? Very much, you know, and the habitual drunkard. And that was a big social policy priority in the 19th century to try and deal with that problem and find institutions where they could be rehabilitated. So, I mean, it was a public health issue very much in the 19th century. And I suppose the interesting thing about the 1920s is now that they now have control over their own laws. And the question is whether there is an association between Ireland and excessive drinking, and is that doing damage to Ireland's reputation?
Then we have the Holy Hour. Tell us what the Holy Hour was for on a Sunday.
Well, I mean, the whole idea, of course, is that there's also a very strong church lobby and a history of temperance in Ireland. And there was a concern that pubs should not be open on the day of rest and on the day of our Lord. And there were compromises reached along the way. St. Patrick's Day is also deemed to be a day not for celebrating in pubs. Pubs are closed on St. Patrick's Day. So there are strong impulses to try and reflect the religious ethos of the state through the licensing system. And of course, some of them lasted until relatively recently.
Yeah, the 80s, that was when Holy Hour was
And you also had, you know, it was a very male culture. You know, the pub drinking culture was very much dominated by men. There was a survey of rural Limerick in the 1960s that suggested a respectable woman would not set foot inside a bar unless there was a grocery shop attached. You know, there could perhaps be the opportunity for a surreptitious Swifty if they were shopping. But, it's very much a male culture.
The women were allowed to go into the snug, though, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. And particularly around Dublin as well. There were the street traders who would have drank in the snugs, but they weren't equipped for women. They didn't have women's toilets, for example. And you can see the emergence of the kind of modern lounge bars after the Second World War, where suddenly carpets are appearing and leather settees and different types of lighting, because a lot of traditional Irish pubs were very dark places. Mm-hmm. And they were deliberately designed in that way. And there was, as part of the women's liberation movement, a crusade to confront the publicans, who in the 70s and 80s still would not serve women and certainly would not serve them a pint of beer.
Yeah.
You know, Nell McCafferty and her comrades went into a Dublin bar at one stage and she ordered nearly 20 whiskies, which women were allowed to purchase, but she then ordered a single pint and she said she wouldn't be paying for any of them unless they were allowed to buy the pint.
They drank the shorts though, didn't they?
Yeah, so there were, you know, there were quite public confrontations with that male culture as well, but you know, it lasted until relatively recently.
And the pub was for more than just socialising and drinking alcohol, wasn't it? It was a place of business. It was a place for matchmaking as well, an important cultural hub.
A lot of people were paid in the pub, you know, and that was problematic in all sorts of ways, as you can appreciate, when people got their wages in pubs. Sometimes publicans were referred to as the political landlords. They had enormous power within their community. And because there were so many licensed premises in Ireland, they often had to diversify. So they could be the undertaker as well as the publican. They could have other business
or
interests.
The grocer. Or
the estate agent or whatever it was. You know, they combined these, which meant that they were very prominent individuals and very powerful and very well connected politically. And of course, it was interesting, even when the smoking ban was introduced in more recent times, that there was a feeling that the power of the publican was waning, because they launched a very vigorous campaign outlining how this would impact on the traditional small pub. And of course, they had understandable concerns there. But their arguments were not going to be able to defeat the arguments of public health campaigners. So you can see how there's a cultural shift. And of course, there are all sorts of shifts throughout the Celtic Tiger era as well, because those pubs are already coming under pressure. Last year, I went to see a production of The Weir, the play by Conor McPherson, which was 25 years old. And it's set in one of those small rural pubs. But it's set in the late 1990s, where you can already see how they're under pressure. This is Brendan, who inherits the family farm and the pub that's attached. But neither of them are commercially viable. But there are still innate decencies and civilities in the pub. You know, it's a vital lifeline for people. It's a place where stories are told. And of course, the pub served that function. I mean, you could talk about the rural post offices and the rural Garda stations and the pub, that sense of community hubs. So, you know, traditional Irish pubs are very much a part of that. And they're coming under pressure from the 1990s. We have the super pubs, obviously. We have increased focus on food. There's much more focus on home consumption as well. Because even in 2000, three quarters of the drink that we were consuming was being consumed in pubs. And it's less than half that now. There were a lot of references during the Celtic Tiger to us beginning to mirror drinking habits of the continent, you know.
Drinking wine. The wine revolution.
There was an explosion in wine. I mean, there were less than 2 million cases of wine sold in Ireland in 1990. And by 2020, that had gone to over 10 million. And most of that is being consumed at home, of course.
Just going back to the smoking ban, and TG Cahir did a great programme on the story of that at the time. And we can remember the pressure that came from publicans. I mean, they said, this will be the end of us. And they did suffer in the aftermath of it for a time.
I mean, the footfall certainly went down. I think the ones that suffered the most were those very small pubs that maybe didn't have the capacity or the money to adapt and change their premise. You know, so that there isn't a one size fits all when it comes to a measure like that. They were never going to win that particular argument. But they also made some outlandish claims about the thousands of jobs that would be lost and the idea of it being the final nail in the coffin. You know, there's been reference to the final nail in the coffin now for decades. And there are less than 7,000 pubs in the Republic now. So you could say that we've almost halved from the period that we started with 100 years ago. But there are, of course, those who are able and have the capacity to be able to adapt.
And what do you say now to those who say that the traditional Irish pub is either dying or dead?
Well, there's very little you can do, you know, because there is not going to be a reversal of that fundamental change. What's fascinating, I suppose, for me is that the traditional pub is becoming more of an exception rather than the rule. And there are people who are seeking them out precisely because they see it as representing a particular heritage. And you can go right back to Ulysses and Bloom wondering, could you cross Dublin without encountering a pub? You know, the pub is almost a character through some Irish cultural expression. And there are also those who believe that it provided an essential release and an escape, what sociologists would refer to as a kind of a safe third space, a place of satisfaction and social cohesion. That's more and more difficult to find. But there are also related challenges around rural transport networks and drink driving laws. I mean, there was a time when the slogan was, just two will do.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it was actually believed that it wasn't realistic to expect people just to have one drink, even if they're driving. Whereas now, of course, the mantra is none for the road. So they've all been challenges as well. And, you know, they're not reversible. That's not going to change. But one thing, I suppose, publicans and the licensed vintners have been able to do over the years is adapt to changed circumstances. But you're much more likely to do that if you're in a position of commercial power than if you're a traditional Irish pub owner.
Dermot, thank you very much. Dermot Ferriter there. Now, that's all we have time for today. Thank you for listening. The RT Radio app is there for you to catch up. The programme was produced by Niamh Lyons, research by Ciarán Dunn. Leon Dunn was our broadcast coordinator. James Feeney was on sound today. And it's over now to Louise.